town, Guyana, drank a poisoned mixture. We always say Kool-Aid. You remember the Jonestown Massacre, right? Actually, I was reading a little bit about it, and it wasn't Kool-Aid. It was Flavor-Aid, grape Flavor-Aid, but that's really a moot point when there's cyanide, you know, in the pot. It was a mixture of cyanide and, I know Finnegan was in it. I think that was so that they wouldn't throw it up, if you want to know the truth, because that Finnegan is a nausea medicine, isn't it? I think it's prescribed for cancer patients. So they would squirt that cyanide concoction into their mouth, but they would chase it with Finnegan so they would not throw it back up. Over 900 Americans drank that mixture at the instigation of Jim Jones. Jim Jones, you may not know, had loose connections to the church. Loose connections. It was really the Christian church that he was affiliated with at one point in time. But he was the cult leader, and he, of course, took his own life with a gunshot. But a sign. This was the sign that was over the rostrum, over his pulpit. And it contained a quote from the Spanish-born philosopher George Santayana. Those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Now that's sadly ironic, isn't it? I think 918 lost their life. Well, it's true that those who ignore the lessons of history do so to their own peril. I think I had asked you to turn to 1 Corinthians 10. The Bible is clear that there are negative lessons to be gleaned from history. Because in 1 Corinthians 10, Paul rehearses some of the evil deeds of the Israelites. And he said, you know, there's positive examples and there's negative examples. And he said, don't do like they did. You know, neither let us be, you know, do not commit fornication as some of them did. 23,000 people died in a single day. Look at verse 8. Because of their immorality. It's a reference to the Old Testament. Actually, 24,000 died in all. This is not a contradiction. 23,000 died in a single day. 24,000 died in all. But if you'll look at verse 11, 1 Corinthians 10:11, he said, now these things happened to them as examples. As an example, and they were written down for our instruction, on whom the ends of the ages has come. So that's a negative lesson. You see what they did, don't emulate it. That's a lesson from history, but it's telling us what not to do, right? What not to engage in. So history has negative lessons, but history has positive lessons as well. You know Romans 15:4. Right? This is the verse that I can just remember growing up. I knew that we were going to have an Old Testament lesson if the preacher quoted Romans 15:4. For the things written aforetime were written for our learning. Right? For our instruction, the ESV has, or for our learning, so that through patience and through comfort of the Scriptures, we might have hope. Now underline that. Through patience and comfort of the Scriptures, we might have hope. And so here's what I'm saying. Here's what I'm saying to you tonight. History, properly understood, can teach us and can give us warnings on the one hand, and history can give us hope on the other. There's good and bad. Good to be taken from it, right? Hope, he says, but also warnings as well. And so that's where we are tonight. We're going to talk about a little history tonight. Now, I want to talk about the church. That's what I really want to talk about. And I want you to turn to Acts chapter 2 to start with. What city is that on the screen? I think Kim Butler just said Louisville. I couldn't hear what he said, really. It's not Weaver. Where is that? Jerusalem. Well, you know the church of our Lord was established in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost. In Acts chapter 2, we read about it. If you look at Acts 2:41, it's a familiar verse, but I just want to trace the early growth of the early church. On the birthday of the church, the very first day of its existence, how many members did it claim? 3,000, right? There were added unto them about 3,000 souls, and it says added unto, and presumably that's those who have been baptized with John's baptism. They did not have to be baptized again on the day of Pentecost, because Mark 1:4 says that John's baptism was for the remission of sins, just like Acts 2:38 says be baptized for the remission of sins. So the apostles presumably baptized with John's baptism, and they constituted the nucleus, and they were added unto them 3,000 souls. At least that's possible interpretation of that verse. So 3,000 on day one. Now turn over to Acts chapter 4. You might even put a note at 241C44. Acts 4 verse 4 says, the church soon grew to over 5,000 men. And the reference there is masculine men. And so if you figure, if it had 5,000 men, then you include, you know, there were obviously women who were members of the church, and then there would have been young adults as well. Scholars believe that there were perhaps 20,000 members of the church in Jerusalem prior to Stephen's death in Acts chapter 7. Right? 20,000 members in a city at that time, the population, not on feast days, but just the, you know, regular population was around 55,000. So 20,000 members by the end of Acts 7 out of a city of 55,000, that's better than 1 out of 3. Wouldn't it be amazing if 1 out of 3 citizens in Jacksonville were members of the Lord's church? Right? It's thought that was the case in Jerusalem. By Acts chapter 16, the gospel had reached Europe. And I don't think we often think about that. We think about, you know, the gospel, we think about Jerusalem, we think about cities, you know, the Old Testament cities that come to mind. I don't know how often we think about Europe. Amanda was asking me, you know, the awful terrorist attack, was that in Brussels? And she said, no, where is Brussels? I'm like, you know where Brussels is. You know what you say when you don't know what something, you're like, oh, you know. You know where that is. It's over, you know, it's over there. It's just over there. Well, by Acts 16, the gospel has reached Europe. And by the end of Acts, Acts chapter 28, the gospel has reached Italy, right? In Rome. Paul's in Rome. So we've got Europe, Acts 16, Italy, Acts 28. Now, fast forward nearly 2,000 years. And here we are. We made it. We made it, Dot. Here we are. You ever seen those signs at the mall? You ever seen those signs looking at a map that says, you are here? And you know, I was a kid, and I'm like, how do they know where I am? And it was kind of creepy. Like, you are here. And I'm like, how do they know where I am? And I can never tell where I was supposed to go from there. My sense of direction is still not strong, but we don't care about that. Well, specifically, you are here, if you're here tonight, right? As opposed to those who might be listening later, I guess. You're here. That's the Jacksonville Church of Christ. Picture of the building is on the screen. And, you know, even in a wider sense, if you're a Christian, you are a member of the universal body of Christ that Jesus promised to build in Matthew 16:18, when He said upon this rock, I'll build my church. And so here's where I'm headed. Okay, first thing we said was there's positive lessons to be gleaned from history, and there's negative lessons as well. And the question that I want us to think about, to begin thinking about, is this. How did we go from Jerusalem to Jacksonville? Right? Have you ever thought about that? Have you ever studied that before? You know, to say it in another way, how did we go from Jerusalem to America, Jerusalem to the United States? You know, the Jacksonville congregation has not always been here, right? Well, how did the church come to the United States? If I were to ask this question, I know, I think Ben would raise his hand. But if I were to ask the question, how many of you like to study history? You know, there are some hands that would go up. The nerds. No. I minored in history in college. I did. Biology, major, history minor. Perhaps the two most futile things you could combine in one setting, gnomes. Well, if I ask you if you like history, some hands are going to go up, and some people are thinking, if this is what he's going to talk about, he said he's going to do a few lessons till the summer series, we're going to see what White Plains is doing for the next few weeks because we're not going to be here. If this is what he's going to talk about, we'll go somewhere else. Don't do that. Don't do that. Because if I ask this question instead of saying, do you like to study history, if I said, you know, how many of you are interested in people? Don't tell me you're not interested in people. Nobody in here with a Facebook account or those who lurk on Facebook. You can't tell me if you have a Facebook account that you don't like people. You like people. And maybe you're nosy too. I don't know. You'll have to answer that for yourself. So maybe, you know, history, you hear history and our eyes glaze if we think about it like that. But if we think about it, instead of thinking about it as in terms of dates and just facts to be memorized, if we think of history in terms of people, you know, because that's what history is. That's what history is at its heart. It's a study of people. It's their beliefs. It's their actions, you know, their tragedies and their triumphs. And that's what I want us to do. That's what I want us to study for a few weeks. History, but not history just as dates, like I said. Not history just as, you know, bullet points to be remembered. We're going to focus on people. I think that'll make it interesting. Now, I want you to turn to Ephesians 3. We're thinking about the church. How did we go from Jerusalem to Jacksonville? From there to here. Ephesians chapter 3. You know that the church is not an afterthought. All right? The church, in fact, was part of God's eternal purpose. Alan, do you have Ephesians 3? And would you mind to read 10 and 11 if you don't mind? Ephesians chapter 3, if you're not there, I'm going to ask you to mark a couple of things if you have your Pygma pen 05. Alan? All right. Circle church and circle eternal purpose and connect them with the line. The church has always been a part of God's eternal plan. Before the foundation of the world, before He ever made Adam and Eve in the garden, God knew that He was going to build His church. That's hard for us to understand, but the Bible is clear. It was part of God's. Before He ever made man, He knew that He was. He knew they'd fall. He knew He was going to redeem us. He knew He would do it through His Son. He knew His Son would build the church. All right. And there are, of course, since the church is part of God's eternal purpose, there are prophecies in the Old Testament that point to the church's establishment. You know, you read about this in the twos, Isaiah 2 and Daniel 2, Joel 2, just to name a few. And then it's fulfilled in Acts 2, right? But, however, just as there are prophecies of the church's establishment, there are also prophecies of the church's apostasy. Now, what's apostasy mean? Falling away. Falling away. As early as Acts chapter 20, and we'll look at this one in a minute, but as early as Acts chapter 20, Paul warns the Ephesian elders that problems were going to arise. And specifically, he said they're going to arise from within, and from within the leadership. He was talking to the elders when he said what he said. Think about Galatians 1 verse 6, right? Paul says, I marvel. The ESV says, I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting Him who called you. Right? But I want you to turn to 1 Timothy chapter 4. Because when Paul wrote his first epistle to Timothy, he alluded to apostasy yet again. 1 Timothy chapter 4. Just watching, I'm fixated on Ben and Grat in the back now. I can't even stop watching. You're worse than Jacoby Jenkins in my sixth period class. Jacoby, just sit down. What are you doing? Put it up. 1 Timothy 4. But the Spirit speaketh expressly, explicitly, that in the latter time some shall fall away from the faith. Some shall depart, is that the King James? Fall away from, that's the ESV. And then he tells some of the traits, some of the earmarks of that apostasy, giving heed to seducing doctrines and demons of spirits, or doctrines of demons, forbidding to marry, commanding to abstain from meats. But what I've underlined in my Bible, some shall fall away from the faith. And so, early on, this is still within the first century, right? This is written, I guess, in the 60s, AD 60s. And so it's not like God didn't know that people were going to depart. There's ever present in man a tendency to drift. That's just seems to be almost our nature, that we drift, that we stray, and we have to be brought back. Well, he says, some are going to fall away from the faith. And tragically, in spite of these warnings, right, the church gradually drifted into a state of apostasy. In fact, in many places, you know, virtually every semblance of identity was lost with the church that Jesus built. And even in that first century, there were already seeds being sown that were, you know, going to come to pass of falling away. And so the question that we're going to look at tonight is, how did this apostasy occur, number one? And what we're headed towards is how did they eventually right the ship? How did they eventually get it straightened out? And here's the question that I wanted to ask you. You can raise your hand if you don't. How many of you have ever heard of the Restoration Movement? All right, I see a lot of hands that go up. That's what we're going to be studying. You remember when Scott Harp came during our summer series last time? Scott Harp is an expert on the Restoration Movement. He spoke a little bit on that subject. And I suppose that other than the life of Christ and the teachings of Jesus, I guess I've probably spent more time researching this subject than maybe any other. If I had to guess, I would say after the life of Jesus, this would be what I've spent the most time on. I've gone to foreign countries like Tennessee, and I have been to Kentucky and to Pennsylvania and to West Virginia doing research at different times along the way on this subject. And I guess I just wanted to know all about it that I could. And I'm still interested in it, but there was a time that I was really immersed in this and I wanted to know as much about it, I guess, as I could. Well, what I want to do tonight, because before we can study the Restoration Movement, we've got to study the falling away that occurred. And so tonight I want us to notice the three main steps by which the New Testament church was led away into apostasy. And the first area is organization. Now, after tonight, we'll be gone next week on spring break, but I was already looking ahead to 2 weeks from tonight. And like I said, it's kind of like I tell my kids at school, I guess I try to bribe them sometimes, but I tell them, look, this will be our last real month of having to take a lot of notes, our last month of having to do a lot of book work. In the month of April, we're going to do a lot of labs. And that's what I've got planned, except for seventh period. We're going to color in my seventh period class. I've bought the big crayons and the big books, and we're going to be good to go. But what I told them was, you know, work hard this month, because when we come back from spring break, we'll do a lab every week. Well, the deal that I'm making with you is, this study of the Restoration Movement is going to focus on the people and the personalities that are involved more so than, you know, in 1799, da 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 da. You know what I mean? That's my deal to you. So I want you to turn back to Acts 20, because the first major movement away from the truth is in the area of organization. And this started around the middle of the second century. Now that would be around 150, right? The first century, if that's, you know, 0 to 99. Second century is going to go from 100 to 199. So organization. The Lord wants His church to be organized on the congregational level, right? That's how He organized His church, local congregations. And when a church is fully organized, it's going to have elders, it's going to have deacons. That's Philippians 1:1, that's Titus 1 and verse 5. But early on, I mean, this is 150 A.D. The church was established around A.D. 30. Now we're in 150, right? Men started to change this pattern, and what they wanted to do was organize the church on a larger than local level. They wanted a universal organization, which led eventually to, as you well know, the establishment of the papacy, the pope, right, ruling from Rome. But look at Acts 20. You know verse 28. That's the verse that we always quote. But take heed. Paul's talking to elders, also known as bishops, also known as pastors in the Bible. He says, take heed unto yourselves and to all the flock over the which the Holy Spirit made you overseers. Feed the church of God, which He purchased with His own blood. But look at verse 29. Paul says, I know, so it's not conjecture, it's not speculation. I know that after my departing, grievous wolves, he says, shall enter in among you, not sparing the flock. And I look at verse 30. And from among your own selves. Now, who's he talking with again? He's talking to elders. From among your own selves shall men arise. What will they do? Speaking perverse things. Why will they do it? To draw away disciples after them. I know it's not pleasant to think that there are people, even in the church of our Lord Jesus Christ, who are really only interested at the end of the day in creating a following. Isn't that sad to think? All they want is a group to be loyal to them. Right? Now, they'd never tell you that, but they're really interested in being thought of as, he is some great one. This is my group. These are my people. They will do what I want them to do. Paul says, I know that from among your own selves, people are going to arise to try to draw away and create a following based on them rather than following Jesus Christ. Well, history bears that out because that's exactly how it started. You go back and read church history, right? And from within the eldership, they would have, you know, their meetings. They would get together on fifth Sundays and have men's business meetings. No, I hope they didn't. But whenever, you know, they convene and they would have, and I guess it started innocently enough, who's going to preside over this meeting that we're having? Well, today, well, Robert, why don't you preside over the meeting today? All right. And so he's presiding today. But in time, that became almost an office in itself, the head elder, the president of the elders. And that's just capital W-R-O-N-G. Right? That's not what God intended. And I have heard, bless their hearts, I've heard of churches. And I've heard people, well, he's the head elder so-and-so. I'm like, he's what? He's the head elder. I'm like, there's no such thing. Well, he is. Well, I'm not going there. And pity those that do. They have a head elder. What in the world is that? It's no such thing. Ought not to be, but that's apostasy. That's the root of it. Elders all the same. All on the same team. There's not a head elder. But in some congregations, mercifully, thank the good Lord, not here, but in some congregations, you can bet there are head elders. Whether or not they wear a title that says it or not and have the plaque on the door, there are, and that's wrong. But at any rate, you've got the president of the elders. And in time, you can see how you're going to have one man over a little area. Maybe you've got a bishop now. Which a bishop is a scriptural term. We hear bishop today and our minds immediately go to Catholicism. Bishop's a scriptural term for an elder. But you would have a bishop over an area. Now he has a diocese. And then in time and it spread and it spread and it spread. And eventually over the cardinals, you've got one man over the cardinals and you've got the pope. Right? You've got that in incipient form even early on. That's exactly where it led. So they weren't content to leave the church organized on a local level with each church, each congregation having deacons, having elders. They wanted to organize it on a universal level and one man being over that. Jesus is over it. Jesus is the head of the church, and they forgot that. Hand in hand with that, second step into this apostasy was in the area of doctrine. And I've heard Alan discuss this. Around AD 325, there arose a controversy among some of the bishops of the church. It was about the nature of the relationship among the members in the Godhead. Constantine's the Roman emperor, and he did not want the church, and I'll put that in quotation marks, he did not want the church to divide because that would have been bad for business, that would have been bad for his empire. And so they convened some 318 men together and they at the Council of Nicaea, and they basically write a creed. They came there to reach a consensus, and they adopted what is called the Nicene Creed. Regardless of what the Bible taught, regardless of what the Scriptures said, they wrote down a creed as to what the church was supposed to teach, as to what the church was supposed to believe and practice, and they expected the church members to submit to it. Right? The men of the Restoration Movement will come along later and say, we have no creed, but what? The Bible. What is, you know, the Latin, isn't it? Creare. It just means to believe. Your creed is what you believe. It's not wrong to have a creed in the sense of something you believe in. Ours is Jesus Christ and Him crucified, 1 Corinthians 2:2. We're talking about something in addition to the New Testament when we talk about a man-made creed. It takes on sort of a special meaning of its own. But once that first step in creed writing was taken, it's like, men, we just can't help ourselves. You know what I mean? We have what the Bible says, but we're like, well, that's not enough. We need to write more. What's this mean? What's that mean? We better add to it. And that's just what we do. You know, it reminds me a lot of the scribes and Pharisees, really, in Jesus' day, how they felt like, well, the law just wasn't sufficient, so we're going to have to add to it. And so they did, and they just added burden after burden after burden. And Jesus said, you add all these burdens, but you won't lift them with one of your fingers. And so they just start creed writing. And so you have departures in doctrine. Just essentially people piling their opinions on top of the New Testament. And then number three, the third step, and these all kind of like dominoes are going to tie hand in hand. Let me give you, before I go on, this is not in my notes, but as far as doctrine goes, you might jot this down if you're interested. Sprinkling for baptism. We'll use that as an example. How did that come to pass? It took a couple of false ideas to bring about sprinkling for baptism. One was the idea of original sin, right? The idea that children are born, you know, infants of wrath, and they're going to be condemned. They're born in sin. And so what happens if a child that's born in sin dies? Well, it's going to be lost. If a child dies in sin, if children are born in sin and children die, then children are lost. Well, what do we better do? Well, we better baptize them. It's interesting that they still knew that baptism was necessary. Right? That didn't come. Denying baptism as essential for salvation didn't come along until the 1500s, really. Martin Luther, John Calvin. But at any rate, if a child is born in sin and that child dies, then what's going to happen? That child's going to be lost, so we better baptize it. Well, by baptize, they meant sprinkle, right? Sprinkling water. So you see how one false idea leads to another. The first mention of this in written form about maybe sprinkling water instead of immersion was found in a document called the Didache. D-I-D-A-C-H-E, the Didache, which was sometime around 120 to 160 A.D. 120 to 160, so hey, that's not that far after the church is established and they're already drifting on that. But they said this, and this is how it always goes. They said, yes, but only in case of dire circumstances. Right? If somebody wants to be baptized, they should be immersed. But if there are extenuating circumstances, if someone is on their deathbed, then, you know, we'll make an exception. Who gave you that right to make that exception? Not God. Not God, right? The first documented case of sprinkling for baptism, and it's redundant to say that baptism is by immersion. I mean, the word baptism, baptized, means to immerse. It's like saying immersion is by immersion. It's what the word means. But the first documented case of someone being having water poured upon them was a man named Novation, N-O-V-A-T-I-A-N, 251 A.D. 251 A.D., he had water poured upon him on his deathbed. And that's the first documented case. And I want to say Eusebius, and he's the father of church history, that he questioned whether or not that was really baptism at all. Right? But you can see, you can just see how these things happen. Well, you know, Novation has not been baptized. We know that's essential. It's necessary to contact Jesus' blood. Well, they can't be baptized now. He's on his deathbed. What are we going to do? Just let him die? We can't take him in immersion. We'll tell you what we'll do. We'll do next best thing. Just go get some water. We'll sprinkle it on him and we'll say that's baptism. Well, that's not what the Bible teaches. Well, what kind of cold-hearted person are you? You're going to deny him? At least we'll do this. We'll do at least something. You see how it happens? I wonder how that golden calf got built, you know? I just wonder how the golden calf got built. 251 A.D. Council of Nicaea that I just mentioned, it was discussed and they allowed it again for emergency situations. Now, you define emergency, right? But it was officially approved. It became official Catholic Church doctrine, essentially, in 1311. In 1311 at the Council of Ravenna, sprinkling was officially, do you want to be baptized? You got options. You got sprinkling. You got pouring. And if you're old school, you can have immersion if you must. 1311. Who gave them that right? Not the New Testament. And so, doctrinal departures. And then worship. And that was the third step. One of the changes that came to pass had to do with the observance of the Lord's Supper around the year 1000. How many of you have heard of the doctrine of transubstantiation? Big long word. I see some heads nodding. That's the idea that when we partake of the Lord's Supper, the unleavened bread doesn't just symbolize the body of Christ, it literally becomes the body of Jesus Christ. And so, you can see what happened. Ordinary members like us, ordinary members are not allowed to handle the bread because it was too precious to be touched, they said. And so the church members, if you've ever seen this on TV, I've watched this on TV, church members march up before the priest who lays the wafer on their tongues. And they also believe the fruit of the vine that we partake of didn't just symbolize the blood of Christ, it literally became the blood of Christ. So we can't pass that around. We can't pass that around because somebody might spill it. They might spill the precious blood of Christ. Instead, what's going to happen? The priest is going to drink that fruit of the vine on behalf of, in lieu of, instead of the members. So instead of the Lord's Supper, what we now have is the observance of a Latin Mass. So Lord's Supper changes. And here's another change in the area of worship. Changes were made to the singing arrangement of the church. What does God want us to do when we come together? What did the early church do? They sang. That's what they sang. They did. That's right. Congregational, verbal, vocal music. Ephesians 5:19, Colossians 3:16. Speaking to yourselves, it's a reflexive idea where it's not just one person up before the rest of us and the rest of us are watching their performance. We're speaking to ourselves. We're singing to each other congregationally. Psalms, hymns, spiritual songs, verbal music, speaking, vocal music, right? And you know what's funny today? Is people look at us as members of the Churches of Christ and they think, it's a peculiarity that you practice that you don't use instrumental accompaniment in your worship. Well, we don't, but it's not, and it may be something now that sets us apart, but for the bulk of church history, everyone virtually was united on that, right? A cappella, have you ever looked up a cappella? I always think about, if Mark Martin were here, he would know. Mark Martin likes Andy Griffith like me. When Andy asked Barney, do you know how to sing a cappella? And Barney just starts singing a cappella. No, never mind. Right. A cappella, if you Google that or look it up on dictionary.com, a cappella means to sing in the old church style. Now that's interesting in and of itself, isn't it? To sing in old church style. They know the Lord's people, the beginning, back in Jerusalem, came together. They sang. They just sang around. And this is interesting because it created such a furor, right? Such a problem that they pulled them. Pope Vitalian is said to have first introduced organs into some of the churches of Western Europe about 670 AD. 670. So 6 centuries have passed since the church was established. 6 centuries of just singing together before instruments were added. But the first trustworthy account, where there is some degree of certainty, the first trustworthy account is that of one sent by a Greek emperor to Pepin. Pepin was a king of the Franks in around 755. Right? But again, it created such a stir that they pulled it out and it wasn't brought back in for hundreds of years. And so you go back and study church history, and even when you go to the Protestant Reformation, you'll see that they just sang. And you can show quote after quote after quote from these leading men in the Protestant Reformation whose churches now would use instruments, and they probably are unaware of what their founders said. You know, like, wasn't it John Wesley that said, "I have no objection to organs in our chapels, provided they're neither seen nor heard." Right, Martin Luther, characteristic bluntness, said the organ is a sign of the devil. Basically, he said it's an ensign of Baal. It means it's showing that you're an idolater, at least. Charles Spurgeon, what one said, "Music as a science I esteem and admire." I think this was may have been John Calvin. "But instruments of music in the house of God I abominate and abhor. As a science, I admire it. But in the house of God, no." Charles Spurgeon was the famous Baptist minister who said, "I would just as soon pray to God with machinery as to sing to Him with machinery." So, what's interesting is the Baptist church, the Methodist church, these denominations that we see today, they didn't use it either, starting out. So, it's not that we change, we occupy the original ground. And so, you know, people ask, "Well, why don't y'all use instruments?" And the true question would be, well, you know, and you want to be polite, but the real question is, well, why do you? Because we occupy the original ground. We haven't left. We stand where the early church stood, but you have moved from it. You have moved from it in using instruments in your worship. So, long story short, what have I said tonight? Gradually, step by step by step, right, the church that Jesus built was led away from the New Testament in many ways, in many places. But our question that I want us to focus on for just a few weeks, and like I said, tonight's was more doctrinal than the others will be in terms of how we're going to approach it. I'm going to approach this from a study of the people. 2 weeks from tonight, we're going to look a little bit at Henry VIII and a little bit at Martin Luther, but then we'll look at Barton Stone and we'll look at Thomas and Alexander Campbell. We're going to look at the people because that, to me, is what makes it interesting. And so our question that we're going to focus on is this. How was the church restored to its original order? It fell away. How did we go from Jerusalem to Jacksonville? So how was it restored? But here's the thing. What practical lessons can I take from this study? What can I learn from this that happened so many years ago? Make this practical for me. What can I take to make me a better Christian and better prepared to teach others? Because that's what the old sign said that I started with. Those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it. We don't want to repeat the bad. We want to learn the good and emulate that. So I'm excited about the study, and I hope that you'll be interested in it as well. Thank you so much for being here tonight. And I meant to say, and I didn't, that it's good to see Judy Isabel with us. We're so glad that she's with us tonight. I just forgot, but we're so glad that you're able to be with us. Thank y'all.